From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Hamtramck, Michigan, where the stadium that served as the home for the Detroit Stars will soon see new life. Hamtramck Stadium was one of many Negro League ballparks in the early 20th century, when African Americans were banned from Major League Baseball. Now, it is one of only five left standing. Fans of baseball history and the family of former Detroit Star player Jack White are pushing for the ballpark's restoration. As reported by CityLab, the campaign, quote, interrupts the pattern of preservation, tending to favor the structures built by dominant wealthy white people, a pattern that presents a distorted view of the past, end quote. Think about the homes of famous industrialists and presidents. What stories are being told? What story is not being told? What history is not being shared when the emphasis is really only on white wealth or spaces? In recent years, the preservation movement has been working to be more inclusive, but as our guests this hour will tell us, there's still a long way to go. Diversity in the field is the focus of this year's statewide preservation conference hosted by the Landmark Society of Western New York. It kicks off tomorrow in downtown Rochester. More than 350 voices in the preservation movement will take part in the three-day event. They'll discuss successes, challenges, and strategies for how to make the profession more inclusive. Now, this year's keynote speaker is architectural photographer, writer, and lecturer Lee Bay. His work centers on the documentation and interpretation of the built environment and the often complex political, social, and racial forces that shape spaces and places. He joins our panel this hour for a preview of the conference and a look at the current state of diversity in the preservation movement. So welcome to Lee Bay. Nice to have you here. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is Caitlin Mivas, who is a preservation planner for the Landmark Society of Western New York. Thanks for being back here.
Always glad to be here.
Wayne Goodman is executive director for the Landmark Society. Hello again.
Hello, Evan.
And with us on the line is Brent Leggs, executive director of the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Brent, welcome. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Why don't you tell us about what the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund with the National Trust for Historic Preservation is and some of the roots of it, Brent?
The African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund was born in the aftermath of Charleston and Charlottesville, where culture, heritage, and public spaces collided in the most violent and negative way. And as a response, we wanted to showcase that historic preservation could be a tool for advancing social justice and a solution for communities facing these threats to public spaces. So this campaign is a $25 million multi-year initiative to uplift the stories of African American struggle and achievement and to support the preservation of 150 sites associated to Black activism, achievement, and community. And I'm delighted that we're working with a new social impact community of leaders, including Darren Walker of the Ford Foundation, actor and director Felicia Rashad, and other luminaries that's helping us to advance and really transform the U.S. preservation movement.
All right, well, let's kind of start there with the state of the preservation movement. And I'm going to ask Lee Bay to kind of start with some opening thoughts for us, because he's going to be offering this presentation and the keynote here for the Statewide Preservation Conference. When we talk about who is doing the preserving, that often leads to what gets chosen to be preserved, I assume. But how do you see the kind of the state of this movement?
You know, it's improved over the years. I've been covering as a journalist and lecturing about preservation for almost 20 years now. And, you know, it's really gone from George Washington slept here, Frank Lloyd Wright designed this, to a more toward a more diverse memory of what's there. I think now we're at this critical point because socially, there's a lot of things happening, of course, over the past two to four years. African Americans are beginning to leave large cities in huge amounts, going back to the South. You know, what gets landmarked, what gets remembered of that time as well as the time before? There are new Americans coming, you know, and have been here, obviously, for a while. What gets landmarked, what gets remembered, what spaces are honored that they create? So all this stuff is kind of like in a soup at the same time. And I think it's critical for us to either understand this and address this or at our peril, pretend it doesn't happen. If I can conclude, there is an idea that preservation is elitist, right? That it's white middle class, upper middle class, endeavor. To change that, we have to get new voices in, new places in, new memories in order to combat and change and improve it.
Okay. Brent, how do you see it?
I agree with Lee's remarks, and the preservation movement is shifting. I've been in the field of preservation practice for nearly 15 years, and over that time, I've been able to see both the shifting at the National Trust, but more broadly, that communities are advocating for the protection and preservation of places that are important in American history, diverse places that are important in American history. And I think the Action Fund is an exemplary example of the way that Americans at the grassroots or professionals are collaborating, reimagining preservation practice, and advancing new approaches that involve more diverse voices and community members in the kind of process for reusing and interpreting these spaces. And I could give you examples like our National Treasure Campaign that is working to preserve the childhood home of Nina Simone in Tryon, North Carolina, working with a diverse community of African American and Latino professionals that care about amplifying her contribution as the voice of the civil rights movement, or even the Southside Community Arts Center in Chicago, which is this beautiful and elegant space where Black artists could express their own art and creativity. There are a lot of examples where communities have organized and are directing resources to save these important places.
Hmm. Wayne, Rochester is hosting this year the statewide conference that starts tomorrow. What do you see as sort of the role of the Landmark Society? And then how do you see, more broadly speaking, this question of diversity in your field right now?
Yeah, so the conference, Caitlin, this is what the, how many years have we done the statewide conference now?
About
I lose track.
5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, so we're happy to be hosting the statewide conference this year in Rochester. It's been going back and forth between Rochester and Albany and central New York, and we have a lot of partners across the state. So we're excited. Every year we're excited to bring the conference, or every other year we're excited to bring the conference back to Rochester. You know, on the topic of, I think, diversity in preservation, at the sake of just echoing what's been said already, I think I've been in preservation for now a little over 20 years, and the playing field has changed dramatically in those 20 years. However, I think that we still have a ways to go in the preservation movement. It's an interesting time, I think, with all the questions surrounding and concerns surrounding social justice. I think that the one message that we would like to convey in this conference is that there's a pretty large umbrella and that preservation really unfolds. And we have to be more cognizant to represent the voices of everyone and what's important and significant to those citizens. We're all one big community, and preservation should reflect that. The challenge is, how do you get there? And that's why we bring in experts like Lee and Brent, and I think we, as a Landmark Society, are happy to really host this type of discussion to really plot where we move from here.
Caitlin, I suspect you and I are in that same category of formerly young people.
Hold on a second.
I'm formerly young.
Speak for
yourself. You are a young person. I want to ask you, you know, sort of, if you feel a little bit like I have felt in my own career path, which is that, you know, being a white man in journalism, I didn't think a whole lot when I first graduated. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion in school when I was in college about what the makeup of newsrooms look like, et cetera. As my career has progressed, as I've thought more about it, as I've encountered more important perspective, I think a lot more about it. And I think about the weight of the responsibility of having this microphone, having this job. And I wonder if, because obviously right now journalism is still pretty white in this country, preservation similar in some ways? Do you feel thinking about it more, and you feel more sort of a weight of your role in it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, I mirror your experience too, in that I didn't really start to actively think about this until probably 5 years ago. And I think increasing inclusion in the field of preservation really has to, in any field, has to start like internally with yourself. So, you know, thinking with yourself about, okay, well, in what ways do I perpetuate, you know, implicit bias or racism? You know, what ways am I perpetuating systemic racism? And what can I do, you know, in how I think about my implicit bias and how I act out, you know, things in my daily job or my daily life? You know, how can I help improve that? So that's, you know, kind of the personal work I've been doing for the last 5 years. And I do feel I've really kind of taken on this passion to do what little bit I can to try and bring preservation locally and preservation big picture to be more inclusive and to help kind of break down systemic discrimination and racism.
Sure. Another parallel would be in journalism. It's what stories you choose to cover. You don't have to intentionally in your heart exclude, but if you are sort of got some blinders on, you may cover only a certain segment
exactly.
of the community. Same kind of thing in preservation, you know, what you choose to put the emphasis on, either the dollars or the efforts, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, so much of what we do, it's not just about preserving, you know, a four-walled structure. It's about telling what stories we're telling and what people were engaging with to tell those stories. Because preservation really is about people. So yeah, what people are we working with? What voices am I hearing from? Am I reaching out to? Who am I welcoming into the tent? All of that.
Okay. Lee, when it comes to what the concern is and what we may be missing in terms of what the kinds of preservation that could happen if either the field was more diverse or if there was at least a better approach that is more inclusive, the kind of work that Caitlin and Wayne are talking about doing. What are the kinds of things that would change in our communities?
You know, as Brent said, one of the interesting things about this is that as opposed to it being something that comes from the top down, we've decided what's important in this community and what, you know, and therefore what isn't, that suggestions and activity comes from the bottom up. You're going to see some interesting places if these voices are allowed to really take hold. Be landmarked. I mean, you're going to see, I think, over time, interesting things that are important to these communities. I'm thinking about in Chicago, where I'm from. You know, there's a skating rink on the south side that's been there, I don't know, 40 years or more. And the owners there are thinking about, you know, should we keep going or should we not, that kind of thing. And there's been a big hue and cry to protect and keep and honor this space. I think a movie was filmed there or two. And I can see these kind of unique spaces that speak to, and I should say that roller skating. I don't know, roller skating is huge in Black Chicago amongst certain segments, especially. It's social, it's everything, particularly if you're of a certain age. So I think you're gonna see spaces like that. You know, certainly, you know, for instance, you know, the period after the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement of the 70s and things, I think you're going to see more spaces and places like that honored. I think also, and this is where it's going to get really tricky, I think you're going to see places that aren't necessarily happy stories about America that these communities are going to want honored. In Chicago, the West Side Apartment, or the place where the West Side Apartment used to be, where Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, Black Panthers, were killed by the city's police in a raid. You're going to see these kind of, there's a similar story in Houston. I think you're going to see these kind of tricky and complicated histories being told, but they mark our place here in America, mm-hmm. and they add diversity to the story of what we preserve and what this American story is, preservation-wise.
Brent, what do you see changing if there's more diversity and more of a diverse focus in this field?
I agree with all of the panelists. Part of our aspiration through the Action Fund is to reconstruct national identity, and that is telling more stories that empower Americans and that help them to see themselves and their potential in the American cultural landscape. So that is advancing the preservation of sites of activism, achievement, community, highlighting the role of Black architects, and highlighting the places of the everyday experience, like the roller skating rinks in Chicago or the cultural spaces of the lesbian and gay communities in our cities across America. And so part of our response is to really target our focus in developing the next generation of preservation practitioners. We have a program called Hope Crew, and it stands for Hands-on Preservation Experience. And we currently are working this weekend at Frederick Douglass's house, Cedar Hill in Washington, D.C., and they are learning how to restore this cultural landscape. Or we have created a preservation practicum at Morgan State University, working with students in the School of Architecture as a way to introduce them to the field and profession of cultural preservation. And then we have a scholarship program called the Mildred Kolodny Scholarship Program. And I had the good fortune of being the recipient of this program in its second year, back in 2003. And it was my entree both to the National Trust, but to this amazing career that we call historic preservation. And, you know, today I have the opportunity to consider myself a cultural entrepreneurship, an activist, and am helping to lead the preservation of these diverse and important places in American history. So with that being said, there are a lot of opportunities to inspire and engage the public in this work.
When I look at what has happened in just the last probably, 2 weeks now, even less since Notre Dame burned in Paris, there was initially, I would say in the first 24 to 48 hours, just some questions raised from people, especially in this country, asking, okay, we understand that this is an international landmark, has a lot of meaning, that's why a lot of attention and money is pouring in from around the world. What about the Southern Black churches that have burned? Well, now, Vox reports, and thanks to producer Megan Mack for grabbing these numbers for us, in the aftermath of Notre Dame, the attention raised for Southern Black churches was much stronger, predominantly Black churches that were targeted by arson. And now more than $2.1 million, more than $300,000, more than the churches said they needed to rebuild, has already been raised. Brent, is that a sign to you that that progress is maybe not where you would want it to go, but when the public sort of wakes up a little bit, that there is interest, that there is concern? Or do you see that differently? How do you see that?
African-American historic places traditionally have been undervalued and underfunded, and that's why we created the Action Fund, and part of our campaign is establishing a national grant program that will be $15 million that will provide direct investment and support for the preservation of Black churches and other historic sites. So I was really pleased to see the public stand up for these historic churches, to invest in their preservation. And I believe that once the public is educated and informed about the need, then there is a response in this social action. And I hope that we can build on that, build on the work of the Action Fund, and to continue to go beyond a $25 million campaign, but think about achieving a scale that is appropriate for the need. And I'll give you a statistic. So when we invited proposals in 2017, we received 830 proposals from 42 states requesting nearly $91 million. At that time, we were able to invest $1.1 million in 16 preservation projects. This year in July, we will invest nearly $2 million in approximately 20 preservation projects. But again, African-American historic places and other diverse historic sites continue to be underfunded, undervalued, and this is a real charge to our nation to be part of this emerging social movement and to direct both financial, intellectual, and other resources to activate these public spaces.
You want to add to that, Lee?
This is so critical. What you're finding, at least in many large cities, mine included, is that there's a shift where African-American worshipers are leaving and going to larger, newly built, mega churches in some cases. And they're leaving these older buildings behind. So these congregations are small, and they're stuck with the bill of these magnificent churches. We lost the Louis Sullivan Church, Adler and Sullivan Church, Pilgrim Baptist Church, around 12 years ago, due to roofers. The church fathers, mothers, fathers found discount roofers to fix the roof. They had torches. They touched the thing off, and they burned almost to the ground this building, which actually has two histories. It was originally a synagogue and then became African-American church in Bronzeville when the Black population moved in. Thomas Dorsey, gospel pioneer who essentially creates gospel music, did his work in that church. His papers were in that church, all lost. So Brent's program and the work of the trust and work of organizations like the ones here are so important to give attention, even in some cases, professional advice. How do you fix a church roof in an affordable way without burning the thing up? You know, that kind of deal. Also very important.
Yeah, I want to, Caitlin, I want to look at maybe like the optimist in me wants to look at the Southern Black Church story and with the spirit that says, like my own experience, I didn't grow up indifferent about redlining. I grew up totally uneducated. Totally uneducated, which says a lot about maybe public education and the work that needs to be done there. But the more education I've got, certainly the more interest I have in making sure that my own child is educated about it and the conversation happens and the question of justice happens. I want to believe that when people are educated, that they do want to kind of step in. And so maybe this story is an indication that with better education, with more sort of equity as we look at your field and others, that that there isn't going to be an indifference to history or preservation.
Yeah, and I think that I think statistics show too that younger generations are less concerned have less prejudice, racial and less prejudice against different races and sexual orientations and all of that. So I think, I think that naturally things will improve in that regard too. But yeah, I think the education is such a big piece. I didn't even learn about redlining in my graduate school program in preservation. And so that is so important to explaining like where we are today in all of our cities. So we're going to start the conference with that kind of setting the basis for the conversations we have. We're going to have a quick talk on segregation and redlining in Rochester specifically, because I think it's so important to understand, why certain communities of color are disadvantaged today because of the systemic, the system was, built against them.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this, Wayne?
No, I think those are good points. I'm pulling a comment to Evan that you mentioned about when you were young. I have young daughters, and what I guess their attitudes, what they've learned, their friendships, it's just quite different, even from my upbringing. And I think that's a positive thing. And I do believe that most people, whenever they become educated and whenever, they dive in to the facts and really learn the history, I have found that most people are fairly open and are welcoming this type of change in the preservation movement. The caveat is there's still a lot of work to be done, and that's why we're here. And that's why we made the focus, and I have to give Caitlin credit for really pushing this issue locally and making this the focus of this conference. One thing I do want to add about another point, if I could just really briefly, I think a big key will be to, in the future, making sure that particularly graduate-level preservation programs in this nation really start addressing some of these types of concepts.
Yes.
Not only about the histories and the stories that are told, although that has to be the backbone of the work, but there's also the question of economic equality. And when we invest in our historic buildings, there should be a yield, right? There should be a positive yield. And who benefits from the positive yield? And that's a question that becomes extremely complex, but it's one that I think has to start with our training and our young preservationists who are entering the field.
Well, in a moment, after our only break of the hour on the subject of training, we're going to come back and talk about what it means to train in the way of cultural competency, because it's one thing to talk about a lack of diversity in any particular field, teaching, journalism, preservation. It's another to say, can you bring more cultural competency through training, through effort, through really sort of intentional, mindful work. And we're going to talk about what's not only happening here in Rochester, but what our guests think could happen in the field that might change that. So we're talking about the 2019 Statewide Preservation Conference that's coming to Rochester starting tomorrow, going over the next 4 days or so. And our guests in studio, you just heard Wayne Goodman and Caitlin Mivas from the Landmark Society of Western New York, who have helped organize. And Lee Bay is an architectural photographer, writer, and lecturer who is here in Rochester delivering the keynote. And Brent Leggs is on the line with us, executive director of the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Let's get that only break, and we're right back with them on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, how did a bartender save one of the biggest clients for a tech company? The bartender with only half of a philosophy degree, nothing in tech. Well, it's the story of the benefits of arts and the humanities in STEM. And it's a story that happens to be true. There's a new event coming to MCC, and we're going to talk about what STEM needs most next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You don't have to work in the field of preservation right now to be part of the 2019 Statewide Preservation Conference. In fact, you can attend just the keynote on Friday night if you want to. And Caitlin is a yup. I would probably be considered more of a mup, a middle-aged urban preservationist. But wherever you are.
We're stealing that term, by the way.
The mups, yeah.
The mups.
Well, the yups have to be mups eventually, or maybe eventually the alps. But regardless, Caitlin, if people want to attend, even just, say, Friday night for the keynote, what do they need to know about attending for the Preservation Conference?
Yes. So if you don't want to attend the whole conference, which you should attend the whole conference, but if your schedule doesn't allow it, the keynote is Friday evening, and you can go to our website, landmarksociety.org/conference, and you can purchase tickets for just the keynote, and then we'll have a fun party with some local bar food and some local beer afterwards.
Okay, and if you want to clear your schedule and be part of the conference, can you still do that?
Yes, you can still do that. We will have even registration at the door if you want to come to our workshop tomorrow on increasing cultural competency. But the meat of the conference is Friday at Sibley Square, the second floor. So you can come to our registration table as early as 8 a.m. to sign up for that if you're interested.
All right. So when it comes to the work that's being done at this conference with the theme of discussing the importance of diversity in preservation, that's what Lee Bay is going to be talking about when he talks about a new blueprint in his Friday night keynote. And there's so many sort of related threads there. Let's talk a little bit about what cultural competency means, because, yes, we're going to get back to the idea of how do you bring more people of color into the field to begin with. But just on bringing in cultural competency, Lee, can we do that? I mean, is this a field that can have more cultural competency?
You know, it certainly is. We'll have to. And I think that happens, again, by bringing other voices into the mix, that people that were otherwise ignored may have felt unwelcome. One of the things that I noticed when I shot the images for Southern Exposure, the book, is that, you know, I'm out in the neighborhoods all across the South Side, which is vast. The South Side of Chicago is the size of Philadelphia, to give you a sense. So I'm in every neighborhood in the morning, afternoon shooting, and people would come out of the buildings, they would come out, they would strike up conversations with me. To a person, they all knew something important about that building that I was shooting. They all knew why I was there, and none of them are part of the preservation mechanism in Chicago, and I would say that's the same in other places. Mm-hmm. So be able to bring these voices in, these neighborhood voices, these layperson's voices, other things in, and to educate us on what we ought to look at, what it's important, and to help us along the way, I think goes a long way.
Let me turn to our other guest on that. Brent Leggs, how do you feel about cultural competency in the field?
Yeah, I think this is one of the highest priorities, and I'm glad that the Landmarks Society of Western New York's conference will focus on that. I think as a starter, one of the easiest things to do is to begin to value vernacular architecture and understand that these simple, unadorned historic spaces that sometimes at first glance don't hold a lot of meaning or significance, but once you start to pull back the layers and discover that a Pauli Murray lived there, or John and Alice Coltrane composed, you know, Love Supreme or five albums and a ranch style house, that these places are important and worthy of preservation. I think we also have to begin to see value in grassroots, and that everyday citizens that have self-organized, that are newcomers to the field of cultural preservation. You know, in many ways, they struggle to build their own capacity in preservation planning, nonprofit management, fundraising, and are working diligently to build broad community support for their preservation projects. So the cultural competency that I hope that we advance over the next decade is beginning to value the full American story, to move us beyond the elitist traditional spaces that are high-style architecture. And again, we begin to see that preservation is an inclusive, people-centered movement, and that every American can contribute and has value.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put a pin in the phrase full American story that our guest just brought up there. Brent brings that up, and I'll get back to that in a moment because I have an email I want to read, and that's an important point on what it means to be American. But to continue on that theme, what does cultural competency mean, and how do you see this conference addressing that, Caitlin?
Yeah, I want to echo what Lee and Brent said, is that it really is about engaging non-experts, grassroots folks, people from every walk of life, and making preservation a participatory process that everyone can have access to. And like I said before, I think it really starts with yourself. So those of us in the field, you know, looking at ourselves and how is our implicit bias, you know, impacting our work, and understanding the perspectives that other people come from, and really connecting more with people outside of our little bubbles.
Okay, Wayne?
You know, internally, I think that the traditional method that preservationists have used for decades to try and direct focus has been based upon National Register criteria. So we're looking at structures and we're considering age, the historical significance, and then we're also considering architectural integrity. How much of the building is left, how well preserved the structure is. I think for reasons that have already been discussed, a lot of our minority populations, particularly African-American populations in the city of Rochester, that's very difficult. And I think that it's difficult to apply those same types of standards to some sites here that have a strong link to the African-American histories because of what's already been, I think, brought up, and that's the underfunding. Both private funds haven't been there historically, and public funds haven't been there historically to maintain the structures. So we see a lot of structures that could have great significance to certain segments of our community's populations, and that's going to demand that we try to evaluate those properties in a different way than perhaps we have in the past.
We really, as preservation professionals, really, and we're having this conversation across the country, but we really need to take a hard look at some of our traditional preservation programs. Like the National Register has been virtually unchanged since the 1960s. Mm-hmm. So do we need to adjust those standards to be more inclusive of different stories and people?
Hmm. You want to add to that, Lee?
Well, yeah, and very important because, you know, these designations are more, they bring more than just a plaque to a building, right? That there are tax incentives and other things that happen when you create National Register districts, or, you know, in many cities, local landmark districts as well, you know, that can relieve the burden a bit financially of home ownership or fixing these places up to the standards that they ought to be. So there's an economic piece to this that's absent from many of these places when we don't look at it in the way that you two have suggested.
Pablo emails to say, Evan, hola amigo, I'll tell you what this whole conversation is about. It's about what it means to be American and who gets to decide. That's from Pablo. Now, thank you for that. And I want to reference a conversation I heard recently, and then I want to ask all of our guests to weigh in, and I'll start with Brent. I listened to a podcast, a conversation between Ezra Klein, the founder of Vox Media, and presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg, and Buttigieg was saying that right now he thinks the current sort of political discourse is really a kind of a battle, especially the presidential campaign is going to be a battle about whether what it means to be American is more inclusive and broad-ranging, or it's narrowly defined. And we live in a society where, you know, 40 to 45% of Americans, according to the latest pollings, don't consider, for example, Muslims to be mainstream Americans just by virtue of what their religion is. And you can kind of go down the line here. What the notion of un-American is, Buttigieg said, and this is something I'd never thought about, he said that phrase doesn't really exist in Japan or France, what it means to be un-Japanese or un-French. He said the best he could consider in French would be, un-French would be like cooking without butter. But it's not really along racial or cultural terms. The way it is here and the way it can evoke a notion of white or not white enough. And that was a very profound kind of comment on this. So when Pablo emails to say this whole conversation is about defining what it means to be American, and what's worth preserving, maybe what's worth saving is the extension of that. Brent, do you agree with that? And do you think that's part of either the social conversation that's happening now, the political conversation, a real debate about what it means to be American? Because you brought up the phrase, I think the full American story here.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I agree. Part of the transformation today in the cultural preservation movement is democratizing the field and providing access and authority to grassroots organizations and others that are working to do this work. But I think it starts with having more professionals of color who often protect places that's connected to their individual identities, that's rooted in diversity. And that diversity is helping to broaden the civic identity of cities, whether that's rural or urban environments. And so if we have more Muslim Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, and women that are standing up for their individual identity, but also helping to protect and amplify our collective and shared American experience, then I believe that we have greater cultural competency. I believe that we foster and stimulate education and help more Americans to relate to one another better and see our own humanity in each other.
Okay. Lee?
Oh, that's so true. Although I might push back in the case of Japan and France. If I were an Algerian in France or a recent immigrant, I'd wonder how French I am, given what's going on here. And, of course, in Japan, there's a lovely model there that's who's half Japanese and half African, and she's running into some trouble over how. So, but just a little bit.
So these questions of identity do travel across.
They do travel across the world, but I think though where it's important, and I think that the emailer's point is correct. Certainly, is that, you know, when as a country we decide who's American and who isn't, it's a narrowing pool, right? It isn't. We can agree that these are the standards of being American, and this is what it's always going to be. It narrows, and at any point it can exclude any one of us. It can exclude me as African American. It can exclude a left-thinking white person. So this is dangerous ground. And if preservation can play a role with other industries and other disciplines in pushing back at this and saying no, we all are Americans, and here's my story, here's your story, and other things, I think it'll do a world of good.
Okay, Caitlin.
Yeah, I don't think I can say it better. I think, you know, we need to tell the stories of Muslim Americans, Asian Americans, African Americans, transgender folks. A lot of those may be difficult stories that make us as Americans look bad.
It should be. And it should be.
Yeah.
I think.
And I think as Americans, maybe more so than Europeans, we're really uncomfortable with our not so great history.
Mm-hmm. Wayne?
Yeah, you know, not to simplify a really complex issue, but I guess I just see America as a diverse country, and it's becoming more diverse. That's a reality. That's a fact. And so I believe that our built environment and the stories that built environment, the stories that those built environments tell, should reflect that diversity. And that's a lofty goal, and I know it's sort of oversimplifying the complex, but that's the aim. And I think that the whole notion of a social identity should really, I think preservation can lead efforts in that arena that the built environment reflects the social identities, but mm-hmm. then I think we all, as a people, as Americans, need to get to a point where we embrace that built environment as a whole. I get a little concerned whenever we start compartmentalizing And I think it's okay, and we should be focused on specific social narratives and historical narratives. But then at the end, we're all Americans, and we should all embrace and support those individual stories. And we have work to do.
Well, let's talk a little bit about discomfort, because sometimes, whether it's a history book in a classroom or a preservation effort, the easy thing to do is to sort of celebrate the glorious achievements and maybe not want to kind of peel back and see the hard parts. And at least now, I mean, look at Rochester. They have this exhibit, Stonewall 50 Years Out. I think the Landmark Society is touching on this. Is that right?
Correct.
This weekend, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is an exhibit on 50 years since a piece of American history, the Stonewall Riots in New York, that really launched the gay liberation era and movement. Again, something I didn't see in a history book growing up, and painful and difficult. We had a really powerful hour on that on this program about a month ago. But I wonder if some of that is some of these questions about what we choose to highlight is about our discomfort. And Lee, if you want us to be a little more comfortable with being uncomfortable, with understanding our history that isn't always glorious.
We have to be. I'll give you a great example. Down in Montgomery, Alabama, which was the capital, the seat of the Confederacy, where Jefferson Davis took his seat, and where George Wallace years later gave that famous "Segregation Now, Segregation Forever" speech. Right? There were tons and tons and tons of monuments and signs remembering the Confederacy and all the glory and valor that allegedly came from that, and very little talking about the slave trade that made all that stuff, that was the undergirding of all of that. Bryan Stevenson, lawyer, equal rights, from the Equal Justice Institute down there, pushed early on to get signs and markers around the town talking about the history of slavery and African Americans. I stayed in a hotel about a year ago on Commerce Street. Commerce Street was named because the commerce was slavery. They would march slaves, enslaved Africans, from the Alabama River up the street past my hotel to the town square. That movement, him starting with those signs, ultimately leads to the national monument, anti-lynching monument that's there now, which is probably, other than Maya Lin's, along with Maya Lin's Vietnam War sculpture, probably one of the most profound and significant monuments that this country has offered in the past 50 years. So, but he does it in the seat of the Confederacy, where to this day, Jefferson Davis's birthday is celebrated down there. But he made people tell and recognize this uncomfortable story of lynching across the country. And of course, Alabama was the seat of that. And as a result, a monument is built and eyes are beginning to open. That's the kind of transformative power I think this thing can have once we let it do what it has to do.
Brent Leggs, what do you think?
Oh, I think Lee said it well. And we're honored that Bryan Stevenson is a board member of the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund.
Oh,
and the work that he is leading in Alabama, it will benefit our nation for years to come. Some of our projects, for example, the A.G. Gaston Motel in Birmingham, Alabama, we got involved, and most Americans remember the Birmingham campaign in the spring of 1963. And those historical images are mainly interpreted through the lens of violence and barking dogs and fire hoses. But we wanted to flip the script on the American narrative and really highlight the foot soldiers and the power of Black America to develop a shared vision, to organize and consolidate limited resources, and to sustain a commitment to a protest movement. And that's why we're delighted that President Obama established the Birmingham Civil Rights National Monument as a site of activism, achievement, and community. And another example is Shaco Bottom in Richmond, Virginia, second largest slaveholding site in the nation. And when there was a proposed inappropriate development, a minor league baseball stadium, we collaborated with traditional preservation community, grassroots community leaders to mitigate that development project, which is no longer happening. And we're now collaborating with that community to develop a shared vision for memorializing this sacred space. So I say this to say that these historic landmarks can be safe havens for having difficult conversations, for bringing people together, and for envisioning a new future for American cities.
All right, I want to grab a phone call. Erica in Rochester weighing in on this. Go ahead, Erica.
Hi there. Love the conversation. Wanted to kind of give you a somewhat educated perspective. I don't know how else to describe it, but I've always seen when trying to define what is an American, we always end up defining what it's not. I look at it as what flavor of Americanism are you, depending on the subsect or the subculture that you belong to at a particular place, at a particular time. I just feel that it would, when explained in that context of or different flavors, different textures, or however else you want to describe it, it just adds more of a three-dimensional view of Americanism.
Okay. Some thoughts on that? Go ahead, Lee.
Well, you know, I think there's some points there. I mean, I think that, you know, in defining what's American, what isn't, if it happened in this country, it deserves a seat at the table. What often happens is that Latino history, the history of gays, the history of people, others, are seen as just that, history of others. We teach it this certain month and no more. Mm-hmm. We give it this certain week and no more. And as a result of that, we divorce it from the greater American narrative. This conference and efforts like this is about bringing us all together. So you can't have a talk about, I'll give you an example. My last name, Bey, B-E-Y, right? 70 years ago, my grandfather joined a thing called the Moore Science Temple of America. It was a black movement, religious movement, that was based in Islam. It was the first real significant entry of Islam in America. Because this was before lots of Islam, people who worship Islam began to immigrate to America. This story is largely lost. And, I'm not a member of the temple, but this story is largely lost and its impact is largely lost. So it's these stories and others like it. Latinos, for instance, despite Latinos being in this country since before there was an America, only 1%, less than 1% of landmark places around the country honor that heritage. And then when it is honored, it's honored as their heritage. No, it's ours. It belongs to, they authored it. They should be able to control the story and tell the story, but it feeds into, it's a tributary that feeds into the river that we all benefit from.
I think that's well said. Let me squeeze one more phone call. Jane in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, on the preservation movement and gentrification, the question was asked, who gets to decide? And I still don't feel very comfortable with the exploration of that, because there's such risk of disrupting long-term social and political relationships when you start moving people around and scattering them in other areas of Monroe County or elsewhere. So who would decide to do that? I mean, it's almost self-destructive to move people about, especially with the gentrification. So I would like more on some honest dialogue on who's going to make those types of decisions. Thank you very much.
All right, Jane, thank you. I mean, I think the kinds of decisions that Jane's talking about, maybe more equitable decisions would happen if there are, if the field is more reflective of the population. And it hasn't been. So maybe that's an appropriate place in our last 2 minutes to kind of close here. Brent, what do you think is going to happen that's going to bring more people of color into this field of preservation to begin with?
Well, I think the starting point is having the leadership of organizations like the National Trust for Historic Preservation or the Landmark Society of Western New York, really the traditional preservation movement, making a collective decision that diversity is a corporate and professional value. And I think that we're there and we just need to continue to build on that momentum. I think the question of a caller addressing the cultural and racial displacement that's happening in cities that is experiencing a renaissance and increased investment in historic spaces, that we want to be mindful of how that impacts community of colors, that root shock is real, and the loss of social community and fabric has a lasting impact. Imprint on communities of color. So I would just say back to that caller and to the listeners, hold your elected officials accountable for the decisions that they make as it relates to equitable development, and ensure that they are advancing a political agenda that values the full history of their community, that values the historic built environment, and that is people-centered.
I want to mention again, if you want to attend the conference, which starts tomorrow, landmarksociety.org/conference. You can attend the entire conference if you want to do that, or if you want to just attend and hear the Friday night keynote from our outstanding guest this hour, Lee Bay, you can do that as well. So all the information there. Is that right, Caitlin Mivas?
That is right.
All right, landmarksociety.org/conference. Caitlin Mivas, Wayne Goodman from the Landmark Society of Western New York. Have a great weekend and a great conference. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks to Lee Bay, an architectural photographer, writer, and lecturer, and you can understand why they wanted to have him here for the keynote. Thank you for sharing your expertise and experiences.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Brent Leggs, Executive Director of the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Generous with your time. Thank you, Brent, for being with us this hour.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks.
All right, short break. More Connections is coming up.